This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Will Congress reach a compromise on the 2018 Farm Bill? Coming up, political reporter Liz Crampton will join us to talk about a possible vote this week. We'll find out what could be funded, from farm subsidies to federal nutrition programs. We'll also ask what's driving innovation in farming. We'll hear from Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, about the new ag practices that are luring newcomers to farming. Who are they? We'll find out just ahead. And we'll hear about Our Farm in Bloomfield, Connecticut, and its programs to encourage kids and adults alike to grow their own food. First, when you think of the dairy industry and where the majority of U.S. milk is produced, you may think of the Midwest. Do you know where the milk you buy comes from? There are dairy farmers in Connecticut and across New England, but a recent story in the Hartford Courant has highlighted the struggles some local dairy farmers are experiencing. If you're one of them, join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome back into our studio Greg Ladke, environment and agriculture reporter for the Hartford Courant. He just wrote the piece that I mentioned. Greg, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
So let's talk about your story and what led you to report on it, and that has to do with falling milk prices.
Yes. Farmers across the U.S. have been struggling with very, very low milk prices for several years in a row now, and that's led some Connecticut farmers, dairy farmers, to just decide to give up, that they can't get enough money for their milk and continue operation on these farms, some of which have been in their families and in production for decades.
Why is the price so low?
There are a number of different reasons. One is that there's a glut of milk in the U.S. There's more milk being produced, and there are no controls over how much farmers can produce in terms of milk and dairy products. There are also international customers that have fairly recently stopped buying U.S. dairy products, including Mexico, one of our biggest customers. Milk production around the world is up. And when that happens, and the U.S. is not exporting enough milk and dairy products, that means that there's an awful lot of that here in the U.S., stays in the U.S., and that's keeping prices down. That's a main factor.
You mentioned that there's no limit in production. We just did a show on Canada yesterday, and in Canada, they do have a policy that actually limits production. Is that something that's ever been talked about or considered here in the U.S., given the prices having been so low for so long?
I think that it has been talked about, and the problem there is that we've got this free enterprise attitude, and particularly now with the Trump administration, President Trump is very unhappy with Canada, which has a very high protective tariffs for milk imports, because they've made a nationwide decision that they want to keep their dairy farmers in business and to keep the price of milk high so that they can stay in business.
We're focusing on Connecticut because of a story that Greg Ladke did for the Hartford Courant about some dairy farms closing in the state. How many do we know? How many dairy farms are there in Connecticut?
There's about 100 at this point. There's a number of farms that also produce goat and sheep's milk, but there's only about 100 dairy farms left that are in production. And some of those are closing, including the one I wrote about most recently, the Greenbacker Farm in Durham. They're actually this week auctioning off their dairy herd of over 300 cows. And it's very sad to see them, the way they care for those animals, and that they're giving up. They've been farming in Connecticut for hundreds of years, that family.
I want to bring into our discussion Kais Orr. She's a fourth-generation owner and herdswoman at Fort Hill Farms and a member of the Farmer's Cow. Kais, welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
We're doing well. We were talking with Greg about his story profiling some of the dairy farms that are closing and the reasons behind that. You and your family have been in business for a long time. Tell us about your operation and some of the challenges you face.
So we've been farming for well over 70 years here on this part of the farm. And then on our front side of the farm, we've been farming on that for about 300 years. We've conjoined two farms and diversifying. Farms nowadays, we have to diversify. It's not just about milk and cows anymore. It's, you know, some farms are milking goats also, and some farms are milking sheep. Right now, we have a corn maze. The corn maze is planted. We have a creamery that we sell ice cream, and we sell all of our farmers' cow products in. And the other thing is we also, my mother is into lavender. So she has over 1,000 lavender plants, and we sell all types of lavender products and dried lavender. You can pick your own lavender. Technology is growing. It's not cheap, growing. We're putting in a digester, and the digester will produce electricity, and that electricity will be sold to various businesses and to the town of Thompson. We used to produce electricity here on the farm several years ago, back in like the 1900s, and we still have the receipts from them when they were selling. Mm-hmm. And so we're putting in a digester, and we'll also be able to sell that cow manure. It will be like a solid. So when a city folk takes manure back to their home, you won't be able to smell it.
Kais, you mentioned the importance of diversifying and also different ways of bringing in some profits. When we focus in on your dairy, the dairy that's being produced at your farm, can you talk a little bit more about that and how you've either been able to expand or just make do with what you have?
So we are expanding with this digester we're putting in. We're putting in a new barn also, and the new barn will be putting in robots. And so our farm will be able to grow. As we want to grow for the next generation, I'd like my kids to, to be able to farm on this farm, in their years.
How many cows do you have, Kais?
We milk 210. We have 500 total. So we have replacement heifers that come up. And then we also have our milking herd right now.
Now, have you, when we were talking about the price of milk falling for several years now, how have your family been able to sustain your dairy operation?
A big one is diversifying, but also growing in a way of efficiency. I don't have a Fitbit, but I have 150 cows right now that have a Fitbit. And those Fitbits tell me, if the cow is sick, if she's not feeling well, if she's eating, lying down, walking. So it's all about efficiency. We're able to grow our farm because we're diversifying and also being efficient and, trying to make it easier for our employees to, get other chores done here on the farm.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with us, Kais Orr, a fourth-generation owner and herdswoman at Fort Hill Farms in Thompson, Connecticut, also a member of the Farmer's Cow, as we talk about the dairy industry as well as how dairy farms are able to remain open. In studio with us, Greg Ladke, environment and agriculture reporter for the Hartford Courant. He recently reported on a story about some dairy farms closing because of the price of milk being so low. Greg, we heard about what Kais and her family are doing to diversify this new technology, having cows wear Fitbits. Are you hearing that from other farms?
Yes, definitely. It seems like the farms that are able to do what Kais' family is doing on their farm are the ones that are still hanging on, still surviving, even prospering. She talked about robots and more efficient technology, and I think it's interesting that while the number of dairy farms is declining in Connecticut, the number of dairy cattle is remaining about the same. So as these farms close, other farms are picking them up. And there's some of the farms, the largest one in Connecticut, I believe, is in Ellington, and they now have something over 2,800 cows. That sounds like a lot. But in the Midwest and in California, that would be a tiny operation.
Is there a downside to the cows remaining in the state because then they're continuing to produce milk and adding to the oversupply on the market?
That's the other side of this efficiency coin that Kais is talking about. The more efficient these farms are, the more milk they produce, and that continues the oversupply situation and helps keep those prices down.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. John's calling from Meriden. John, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, my question is, what can we do to help local farmers here in the state? I've always tried to buy American products my whole life. I've even returned some products once I've got them home. You know, hardware products, finding out they were not manufactured locally. And I've been told by friends of mine, I know the Greenbackers from scouting years ago, living in the Meriden area. I've been told by some local farmers that have given up farming, don't buy farmer's cow, don't buy this, it's not really Connecticut. And I'm always trying to focus on supporting these Connecticut farmers. What can I do to do more for local farms?
Good question, John. I'll put that question to Kais Orr because I mentioned their farm, Fort Hill Farms, is a member of the Farmer's Cow. Kais, how do you respond to John? Maybe you could explain what the Farmer's Cow actually is.
So the Farmer's Cow is six family farms located here in Connecticut. And we are, you're welcome to come out to our farms, to tour our farms, but it's all about buying local. So, you know, buy your local product from, you know, I don't know if where there's another farm in Meriden, but, you know, it's important to know your farmer. So whether you buy the Farmer's Cow, whether you buy Rody Fresh from in Rhode Island, whether you buy Mountain Dairy, it's all about buying local. We're also part of Cabot Cheese, Agrimark. So as long as you are buying a local product, you are helping a local farmer.
Greg Latke is also in studio with us, and I started the show wondering when do we know where our milk comes from when we buy it in the store? And I'm curious, where does Connecticut dairy go?
I think it stays pretty much in this region. I don't think that Connecticut is exporting much to outside the U.S., there are, as Kais is talking about, a lot of the milk that is produced in Connecticut goes to cheese, which is a very high-value product. Now, one of the problems with President Trump's imposition of tariffs is the retaliation tariffs from Europe and Canada. And cheese is one of those targets for the European Union to place high tariffs on American cheese. That is not good for dairy farmers in Connecticut or across the country. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there.
Kais, do you have a response for that?
No, I just, it's important, buying local. Whether you buy cheese, whether you buy ice cream, whether you buy butter, it all helps. You know, but we encourage to buy milk because that pushes the milk market.
Now, Greg, you also reported on subsidies that help Connecticut farmers. Tell us about this subsidy. I think some of the money was restored this last session, but the problem is a lot of the money set aside has been raided by the state legislature over the years.
Yes, this is the money comes from fees that are paid on real estate transactions, and that's several millions of dollars every year, probably more than 10 million. And those fees are split up between a number of different programs, and one of them is this dairy subsidy. A few years ago, they were putting $5 million or more into this dairy subsidy. But as the Connecticut's government has gone into deficits over and over again, one of the ways that the legislature deals with it is to raid various funds, including this dairy subsidy fund. So it was down considerably. And then last fall, there was more money taken out of it. Just recently, Governor Malloy's administration managed to restore $1.4 million. The legislature in this last session is adding some more back in. but it really isn't enough to compensate for the difference between the cost of producing milk in Connecticut and what milk is selling for. So it's a stopgap measure, and it's been cut and cut again.
Kais, can you talk a little bit about the subsidy that Connecticut provides farmers, dairy farmers specifically? Is this something that you've been able to benefit from?
Yes. yes, we have. And there's a lot of programs that farmers can apply for to help, like the MPP program, the Margin Protection Plan. And that all, you know, that money is comes to us, but it also helps pay our, you know, employees, our feed costs, our local supplies that we, you know, we buy to, you know, from the vet to keep our cows healthy. So, you know, our income, you know, keeps our farm going.
Kais, what would you like to see Congress do in terms of supporting dairy farmers?
So I do think agriculture has grown over the last couple of years in support. I do not think, though, that Congress supports the dairy farmers very much, though. In agriculture in general, yes, I do think they do support, but not the dairy farmers. You know, push for your local farmers. Why are we buying milk from California, Florida? Why aren't we in our grocery stores? Why aren't we putting local milk in the grocery store?
Kais, can I ask you when you say that milk's coming from Florida and California, what brands are they under? Because when people are buying milk, do they see that on the label?
They should, but it's a various brands that that can come in. And then the other thing is, your almond beverage, your silk beverage. It's not milk. You can't milk an almond. Your proteins, your enzymes are in real milk, cow milk. The almond, they call it almond milk because they were able to combine the almond and milk in one word. There's no space. But so when people say, you know, I'm drinking almond beverage, or, you know, they call it almond milk, but it's not. So we strive that, you know, why don't you drink a real milk product, or cheese or butter?
I wanted to go back to Greg Ladke, reporter for the Hartford Current again. He did a story about some of the dairy farms closing in Connecticut. You've spoken with the Ag Commissioner. Is this this trend to continue? Because, again, do we know if dairy prices are going to remain low?
I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen. The tariffs and the trade war that is being discussed is going to play a big role, I think. Right now, and there continues to be this glut of dairy products in the U.S., and it doesn't seem like we're going to bring back some of these international customers like Mexico anytime soon. So I think the struggle is going to continue for a while.
We've been focusing in on just the price of milk and how it's been low for so long. But in your story, you also profile the fact that costs for farmers in the state for electricity, shipping, feed, much more expensive than other big dairy states like Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's another problem that I've heard repeatedly from farmers here and agricultural officials, is that they feel that the dairy system is sort of run by the big industrial scale dairy farms out in the Midwest and Wisconsin and Ohio and California and Florida, and that smaller farmers here in New England are sort of getting short shrift. So it's a tough situation to be a farmer here in high cost, high taxes, high production costs, Connecticut, and the rest of New England as well.
We're almost out of time, but I did want to ask Kaisa Orr again, a herdswoman at Fort Hill Farms, a fourth-generation owner. Kaisa, what keeps you and your family interested in farming?
So if I can tell you I learned anything this year, it's been positive in farming. Farming runs through my blood. My grandfather farmed. His father started this farm, and he kept it going, and I will keep it going. My father passed away this past March, and my plan is to, I feel him over me, and I feel him watching me. And, he was the one that strived this farm to where it is today, and I plan to keep it going. I have some big shoes to fill.
I think we're very lucky that a lot of Connecticut farmers are so stubborn.
Yes. And the next generation, you know, I'm 24 years old and I'm running this dairy farm. It's been a rough year, not just because of milk prices, but also, you know, I looked up to my father and, he had everything, all the answers, you know, and now my boyfriend and I, we came home from college several years ago, and we'll keep farming.
Well, Kaisa, thank you so much for sharing your story about your family farm. We wish you the best. We thank you for joining us today.
Yes. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Again, that's Kaisa Orr, a herdswoman at Fort Hill Farms in Thompson, Connecticut. Also, thanks to Greg Gladke, environment and agriculture reporter for the Hartford Courant. We'll tweet out links to his stories at Where We Live. Thanks again, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, the world's population continues to grow. That means food production will need to meet the demand. So who are the people becoming farmers, and what new crops and farming practices have they embraced? We're going to find out more after the break, and you can join us too, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Some farming traditions have lasted centuries, but innovations have entered agriculture too. Are these new practices encouraging more people to farm? How do they impact yield and access to food? Joining our conversation now by phone is Tracy McMillan, a National Geographic contributor, senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, and author of The American Way of Eating. Tracy, welcome to our show.
Good morning.
So we wanted to know what's driving this recent wave of innovation and experimentation.
Sure. So, I mean, there's a number of things that we're seeing happening. Certainly, there's a lot of concern about the impact of climate change and the booming population, right? So the number that gets thrown around a lot, so that will be at, I believe it's 9 billion by mid-century. And we're going to have to figure out how to feed everybody, even as our climate is changing, which means all the ways that we've been growing food, right, are going to have to change too. So that's a lot of it. But I think you also see a lot of movement just in terms of social forces and sort of different communities coming back to wanting to be part of agriculture and sort of reclaiming that. So you see that a lot in the U.S. With sort of African-American communities and folks coming in, as well as, you know, immigrants who've come from agricultural backgrounds, right, going into farming as they come to be part of the U.S.
Mm. And when you talk about social movements, tell us, was it just in the last few years, or when did this phenomenon really start?
Well, I think what you end up seeing is that there was a big settlement with the USDA during the Obama administration with black farmers. There's a lot of very negative practices from USDA towards black farmers, and this was sort of, in some ways, a way to make up for it, I think. And what you can also see then is more and more folks coming back and saying, you know what? The history of black folks in the South and slavery is a heavy one, and it's terrible, but that doesn't mean that we don't want to be a part of agriculture, right? Certainly there's a lot of black farm communities, particularly in the South, but also in the North, where folks said, you know, this is our history and this is our heritage, and this is something we want to be a part of too.
In studio with me is Darlene Yule, farm education manager at Our Farm in Bloomfield, Connecticut. Darlene, welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thank you.
I was curious if you could add to what Tracy was saying about the changing demographic of those who want to farm, particularly non-white.
Yes, I think you see that happening more frequently. In my past experience working with community gardens and with farm to preschool in New York State, you're seeing a lot more more urban kind of farms pop up, you know, keeping a flock of chickens in your backyard, or right now at our farm, we're doing a 12-week course on beekeeping in your backyard. And so those opportunities are out there. And as Tracy mentioned, as refugee and immigrant populations come in from societies where growing your own food and cooking your own food is more prevalent, I think you're seeing that more frequently in the U.S.
So just changing this idea that to have a farm, you need to be living out in the country and have like several acres. You can actually be doing it small scale in your backyard, depending on your ordinances.
Yes,
With the chickens.
Yes, and West Hartford just recently passed the opportunity to have bees in your backyard, which is one of the reasons why we're running this course.
That's good to know. I wanted to go back to Tracy McMillan. Can you give us some examples? We mentioned that there are innovations happening. So can you talk through some of them with us, maybe starting with aquaponics?
Sure. So, I mean, aquaponics is a system where you're growing both greens and fish off of the same closed-loop system. It's actually drawing off of a traditional Chinese practice where, and this is centuries old, right, people would be growing rice and then the water in the rice paddy. They would have fish. They would have, they'd have fish or ducks and things like that, right, that could eat the pests and then also fertilize the water. And so you have seen this practice get adopted into often small footprint urban or semi-urban farms. So I wrote for NRDC's magazine on Earth last year about a place called Ouroboros Farms out in California, which is a large greenhouse operation that has floating beds of greens, and there's a closed-loop system where the water for the greens is fed into fish ponds with tilapia. The tilapia fertilize the water, and then that goes into the greens, which then greens it gets fed back into the tilapia system. And this is something you also see in quite a number of urban farms. Will Allen, who is the MacArthur Award-winning urban farmer from Wisconsin, has done a lot of work around this. And so you'll see it in quite a number of urban farms around the country.
This is where we live. We're looking at innovations in farming and who the new farmers are across our country. If you're one of them, you can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Tracy, you've also written about maybe some other crops, so to speak, that people may not know a lot about. But when we're talking about, hotter temperatures, less rain, some of these crops are a good thing, including intermediate wheatgrass?
So this is a project coming out of the Land Institute in Kansas. So they've been working for a long time on developing perennial grains, right? So one of the issues with the way we currently grow most of our grain is it's an annual crop. So every year, right, you've got to go in and tear up all the dead crop out of the soil. You've got to replow it, right? There's all this stuff that happens where a lot of nitrogen and carbon gets released into the atmosphere, into the water system, and you lose a lot of soil that way too, right? There's a lot more erosion. So if you have a perennial crop that just stays in the ground and can fix nitrogen in the soil, that's, you know, better for the environment, and if you can get the yields up there, right, can provide a good income for folks. So they've developed something they're calling Kernza, but it's based off intermediate wheatgrass. And so this is something that for years has just grown as forage, or really was more considered a weed, but they've been able to breed it to get enough of a kernel out of it that they're sort of creating flour. There's a number of beers now being brewed with this. And the thing is that the root system, a typical wheat plant, it has maybe a 1 to 3 foot root system, and this has a 10 foot root system and stays in the ground for up to 5 years of the productive yield.
And there's also a focus on insects and how they can be bred and turned into cricket flour.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really tempting, right, when we hear about, like, insects as food, we think, right, there's going to be, like, a cricket kebab for everybody to be eating. But what is actually a lot more practical in terms of insect agriculture is to use it as an additive or as a staple part of any kind of processed food, right? So think power bars or cereals, things like that. It's certainly not a flour in the traditional sense of, like, you know, having gluten and all of that stuff. But you also see sort of commercial insect production being geared towards animal feed as well, right? So high protein feed is great for meat and dairy production. And so people are trying to experiment with ways that you could maybe turn an insect production into a way for animal feed, with the idea that this is, you know, much less of a drain on environmental resources. Crickets in particular can be grown very much in, like, a vertical farm sort of industrial scale. without the same kind of impact that you see from, say, growing a lot of corn and soy.
Again, that's Tracy McMillan, National Geographic contributor and also author of The American Way of Eating, on the phone with us. In studio with me is Darlene Yule, farm education manager at Our Farm in Bloomfield, Connecticut. We heard about a few different innovations from Tracy. Is this something that you're seeing from the young farmers that you're helping at Our Farm?
Well, yes, in fact. So our mission is to engage children and adults and engaging in learning about agriculture and the environment. And so we know that with young children, the more you expose them to fruits and vegetables at a young age, up to 5 years, the more likely they are to eat those fruits and vegetables in adulthood. And it's the same with exposing them to agriculture and the environment. So really our focus is to have children come to the farm, experience what that means throughout all of the seasons. So with our we have a Farm Explorers program where children come 5 to 6 times throughout the year. They're really setting up a baseline for agriculture and the environment so that later on they have the opportunity in their classroom, at home with their families, to continue that agricultural experience. So we have Annie Fisher Montessori School, which is here in Hartford. They come to us about 65 days a year, and that's their middle school program. And they're really learning some new technology, learning how to farm, as part of their curriculum. It's what they call land-based learning. So they're incorporating some of those new technologies now.
So you're encouraging youngsters to have an interest in understanding how food is grown. But I understand you also, Our Farm also partners with UConn's ag program. So when we look at the young farmers of today, Greg Ladke told me on his way out, the average age of a Connecticut farmer is 60 years old. So if we want farming to continue, we need new generations of adults that are interested in this work. It's hard work. Who are the people that are involved at that age, and what are they interested in?
Yes, of course. It's always important to build new farmers, right? And so with UConn, we're a 4-H farm, so therefore we're automatically connected to UConn through through the extension program. But we do work with one of their ag business programs or classes and work with the students directly, in which they take some of our programs or projects or products that we have on the farm and write a mini business plan for us. And at the end of the year, they present their business plan. And it may be something we adopt, it may not, but it's an opportunity for those college students to come to the farm, see how we operate as an educational farm, which is not a typical, like of what we heard Kai say earlier, our dairy farm. We are an educational farm, so all of our products are what I call a byproduct of education. So that is one way that we do work with UConn.
Tracy McMillan, are there other higher ed programs in our country that you know of that are embracing these more experimental practices?
Well, I think every ag school at this point is probably doing a little bit of that. Sort of the flagship for this, though, is UC Santa Cruz, which has a center for agroecology and a program that a lot of growers go through, including many of the leading urban agricultural practitioners in the country. So I know Karen Washington, who came out of the Bronx and now runs Rising Root Farm in upstate New York. I know she's gone through that, as well as some of the other folks in that program, at that farm, as well as there's, in fact, a Farm School NYC, right, which is an urban ag-focused sort of nonprofit farm education program. I know they send a lot of folks through that program. So UC Santa Cruz is sort of the flagship for that stuff, but I think at this point you'll find more interest in smaller scale and alternative stuff popping up at most of the ag schools, although it's certainly not the center of their curriculum.
And Tracy, when we look at innovation in agriculture, what's happening in other countries? Lessons for farmers here? Or I'm just curious if you know of any examples.
Sure. I mean, a lot of the most innovative stuff that gets a lot of media attention, at least, is always the sort of the bigger, shinier industrial ag stuff. So, I mean, you see in China, right, which is grappling with like quite a large population with a fairly small amount of land, and actually, you know, they still have quite a number of small farms, right? Small ag and sort of an almost subsistence of agriculture is a much more common thing there than it is here in the U.S. But at the other end of the spectrum, right, you have things like high-rise, they call them hog hotels, right? So pork production facilities that are vertical sort of industrial hog farms. You also see some of the largest dairies in the world. So I actually was on assignment for for National Geographic there last year and the year before, and visited a dairy that held 40,000 cows. And there are reports of China working to develop a dairy with 100,000 cows, right? So figuring out that very large scale stuff. But you also see in Europe, in the Netherlands, right? They have universities there that are focusing very much on sort of intensive, high-tech greenhouse and heavily monitored kinds of precision agriculture so that they can produce a lot more fruits and vegetables without needing a massive footprint.
Tracy McMillan, again, is author of The American Way of Eating, also a National Geographic contributor. In studio with me on Where We Live is Darlene Yule, farm education manager at Our Farm in Bloomfield, Connecticut. We know we've heard from some young farmers on our show over the last few years. If people are interested in farming, not just studying the best practices and techniques, but then how do they obtain land to farm? And are there innovative programs in the state that connect people with the land?
That's an interesting way to look at things. And I think as more people become interested in where their food comes from, one of the challenges then, if you want to start farming, beyond your own backyard, where do you find that land? And so we do have some community garden plots that, one person is renting multiple community garden plots, and they have plots kind of all across the area. And so they're using that as a method of small farming, where they are renting out tiny pieces of property from community garden areas to kind of build a farm. But there are organizations in Connecticut, such as land trusts, and there's the New Connecticut Farmer Alliance, I believe is the name of it. So they're kind of, building incubator farmers in that way.
Well, I want to thank Darlene Yule again from Our Farm in Bloomfield, Connecticut. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Tracy McMillan, who's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and author of The American Way of Eating. Tracy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. This week, the Senate may pass the latest farm bill, or rather vote on the latest farm bill. What's at stake in Congress? Politico reporter Liz Crampton will have the details coming up, and you can join us too, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Thursday, we're going to introduce you to two Democrats vying for Connecticut's 5th District Congressional seat, Mary Glassman and Johanna Hayes. We'll learn more about them and about the issues they want to tackle if elected. And of course, we want to hear from you, too. If you have a question for them, you can join us on air and on Facebook Live. That's Where We Live on Thursday. Now, Congress may be closer to passing a bipartisan farm bill this week. So what's in it? What's at stake if a compromise isn't reached? For more, Liz Crampton's on the phone with us. She's an agriculture reporter for Politico. Liz, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the latest on the farm bill, the House voted and the Senate may vote this week. Tell us what's in it.
That's right. So the Senate is gearing up to vote on its version of the farm bill, and it's a massive piece of legislation that addresses everything from conservation to commodity subsidies to crop insurance. And it's a big bill that has to be reauthorized every 5 years, and Congress is facing a September 30th deadline to get that done. Mm.
Now, what's the history on the farm bill? This goes back a long ways, and I'm curious why, I think in your reporting, it has been mentioned that extending the 2014 farm bill is actually an unpopular idea, if you could break that down for us.
Well, so this is an opportunity for Congress to impose changes in farm and nutrition policy. And again, it only comes around every 5 years, and so all these various stakeholders view it as their one shot to get their reforms in place. It's really all that they have. And so it's unpopular to extend existing farm bill just because farmers and growers want certainty in the programs that they're receiving. And, they want to be able to make tweaks and changes to the existing programs.
And we should mention the House vote was by a 2-vote margin. I'm just curious about what was some of the opposition, what were the issues within that bill that they had trouble with?
That's right. It really came down to the wire, and we all were on the edge of our seats waiting to see if it would pass. And the way that process happened was traditionally this farm bill is bipartisan. It's one of the last bipartisan bills that Congress has. But earlier in the process of writing the farm bill, it was discovered that House Ag Chairman Mike Conaway, under the direction, of course, of House Speaker Paul Ryan, wanted to make changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps. And Ryan viewed this as, you know, advancing his welfare reform agenda by expanding work requirements for some recipients of food stamps. Democrats wanted to have nothing to do with that. They were outraged. They walked away from the negotiating table because they didn't want to make any changes to the program. So then that forced Conaway to pass a farm bill with only Republican support. But as we know, Republicans are very divided. They are not uniform in their asks and not uniform in how they view the food stamp program. So it really came down to the final votes for the farm bill to get passed. And what's, you know, exceptional about this situation is it's, you know, the first time ever in history that only one party in the House has passed an intact farm bill.
Liz Crampton's agriculture reporter for Politico, as we look into the farm bill before Congress, the Senate may vote this week. What are some other differences in the Senate version, Liz?
So the biggest difference is that, you know, the Senate doesn't really make any changes to food stamps. You know, they make some tweaks about combating fraud, but mostly leave the program the same. Another pretty big difference that will have to be reconciled in conference is the conservation program. The House bill proposes deep cuts to conservation, as well as eliminating one of the flagship conservation programs run by USDA, Conservation Stewardship Program, whereas the Senate Farm Bill doesn't make any broad title cuts. There's some reshuffling of money within the title, and some programs get boosts and some get some, you know, hairline cuts. But overall, it's friendlier to conservation efforts. So how to, you know, merge those two titles in conference along with the other 11 titles in the Farm Bill will definitely be a difficult task.
Is the Senate likely to vote this week, given the July 4th holiday?
Yeah, so Mitch McConnell has said that he wants to get a bill done before the holiday, before senators skip town. Last night, the Senate voted to start debating the Farm Bill, and that will, you know, continue into today. What's happening behind the scenes is, you know, what amendments will be allowed to be introduced on the floor. And Pat Roberts, who is chairman of the Ag Committee, has been a gatekeeper of which amendments can be voted on and which amendments may be included in a sweeping manager's package. So that's the question in these next, you know, 24 hours is what are the final changes that senators are going to try to make to the bill before it's voted on?
I'm glad you brought up amendments, Liz, because I'm curious with the immigration debate going on now, is there any chance of that being inserted anywhere in this large bill?
It's unlikely, but of course, never say never when it comes to Congress. They want to get this bill done, and they don't want to, you know, throw any bombs into the bill that could derail its passage. Because of course, time is ticking, and September 30th is approaching, and we still have the real challenge of this legislation, which is the conference. Mm.
We started the hour talking about dairy farms closing in Connecticut and in New England, the price of milk being low for several years. And I'm curious, what does the farm bill mean for dairy farmers, including subsidies that the federal government provides?
Right. So there are initiatives in the farm bill that, you know, authorize USDA to provide support for farmers. And what's, you know, interesting about this farm bill is the last farm bill, farms were doing pretty well. You know, farm incomes were up. Things looked good for farmers. Whereas this farm bill, that's not the case at all. You know, incomes are declining. As you said, you know, farms are closing on the verge of bankruptcy. And then on top of all of that, there's uncertainty about the trade war. So farmers have been pleading with, you know, their lawmakers, you know, please pass the farm bill on time. I want to know what to expect, especially in these troubled times.
And what about the trade disputes the U.S. is now having with Mexico, with Canada, with our EU partners, and how that will trickle down to impact U.S. agriculture, Liz?
I mean, we're really seeing, farmers, at the chopping block, they're the ones that can experience the biggest harm in terms of retaliatory tariffs. In industries, especially pork, soybeans, they're the ones who are, central to these threats. And it's concerning. We're talking about real money that's at risk, and these farms depend on exports. So it is a pretty nervous time for them, and they're afraid. We're hearing that they're worried about whether or not this administration is going to follow through and protect them as what's been promised. Mm.
And these farmers are also constituents in districts where they have lawmakers right now considering a vote. Is that putting some pressure on some of these lawmakers, Liz?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's the first thing that farmers say is, I don't know what this trade war is going, how this is going to impact my farm. And, when lawmakers, talk to us about the necessity of getting a farm bill done, they always mention that farmers are facing, tough times right now, and we need to pass a farm bill because, the tariff threats is just one more thing that they have to deal with.
And did you say earlier, Liz, that the Senate's planning on voting, right? But what are the odds of a compromise could be reached after the conference between the House and Senate bills?
I mean, it's hard to make predictions, but they have said that they're committed to getting it done. What's interesting to watch in this situation is House Ranking Member Colin Peterson, because he has said that he's going to play ball with his Senate counterparts during conference. And so to see, this 3-on-1 against Mike Conway will be interesting to watch, and what changes may have to be made in the farm bill in order for Peterson to unleash Democrat support.
Earlier we talked about SNAP and the House Republicans supporting making work requirements stricter for recipients. I was wondering, we just got a tweet from a listener who writes, "Wish more people understood that most recipients of SNAP are already working. Work requirements and documentation of exemptions will add unnecessary bureaucracy and lead to people going hungry." So this is something, again, that the Democrats are listening to when they go to vote.
That's right. And Democrats are having to make the calculus. We will walk away from supporting this farm bill because of its changes to nutrition programs, hoping, of course, that they could retake the House in November and be able to write their own farm bill if, of course, this current farm bill doesn't work out.
Liz Crampton, again, is agriculture reporter for Politico. We'll tweet out some links at Where We Live. Liz, thank you so much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Kion Wolf, Katie Tolarski. Our WNPR intern today is Jason Perez. And don't forget, on Thursday, we're going to have the first of many candidates before that August 14th primary coming in this Thursday, with candidates for the 5th District. The Democratic candidates will be joining us, Mary Glassman and Johanna Hayes. And we'll be on Facebook Live, too. So make sure you send us your questions. And we look forward to speaking with you on Thursday.